Okay, what do we know? Nozenko opened the map case he'd been carrying and laid out a large sheet on the floor as the aircraft lifted off. It was of the Chinese-Russian border on the Amur River, with markings already penciled in. The American officers all leaned over to look.
They came in here and drove across the river.
How fast are they moving?
Bondarenko asked.
I have a reconnaissance company ahead of them. They report in every 15 minutes,
Colonel Tolkunov replied.
They are moving in a deliberate manner. Their reconnaissance screen is composed of WZ-501 tracked APCs, heavy on radios, light on weapons. They are on the whole not very enterprising, however. As I said, deliberate. They move by leapfrogging half a kilometer at a bound, depending on terrain. We are monitoring their radios. They are not encrypted, though their spoken language is deceptive in terminology. We are working on that.
Speed of advance?
5 kilometers in an hour is the fastest we've seen, usually slower than that. Their main body is still getting organized, and they haven't set up a logistics train yet. I'd expect them to attempt no more than 30 kilometers in a day on flat open ground, based on what I've seen so far.
Interesting.
Bondarenko looked back at his maps. They'd start going north-northwest because that's what the terrain compelled them to do. At this speed, they'd be at the gold strike in 6 or 7 days. Theoretically, he could move 265th Motor Rifle to a blocking position here in 2 days and make a stand. But by then, they'd have at least 3, maybe 8 mechanized divisions to attack his 1 full-strength unit. And he couldn't gamble on that so soon. The good news was that the Chinese were bypassing his command post. Contemptuously, he wondered. Or just because there was nothing there to threaten them, and so nothing to squander force on. No, they'd run as fast and hard as they could, bringing up foot infantry to wall off their line of advance. That was classic tactics, and the reason was because it worked. Everyone did it that way, from Hannibal to Hitler. So their lead elements moved deliberately, and they were still forming up their army over the Amur bridgehead.
What units have we identified?
The lead enemy formation is their 34th Red Banner Shock Army, commanded by Peng Shiwang. He is politically reliable and well-regarded in Beijing, an experienced soldier. Expect him to be the operational army group commander. The 34th Army is mainly across the river now. 3 more Group A mechanized armies are lined up to cross as well, the 31st, 29th, and 43rd.
That's a total of 16 mechanized divisions, plus a lot of other attachments.
We think the 65th Group B Army will be next across. 4 infantry divisions plus a tank brigade. Their job will be to hold the western flank, I would imagine.
That made sense.
There was no Russian force east of the breakthrough worthy of the name. A classic operation would also wheel east to Vladivostok on the Pacific coast, but that would only distract forces from the main objective. So the turn east would wait for at least a week, probably 2 or 3, with just light screening forces heading that way for the moment.
What about our civilians? Bondarenko asked.
They're leaving the towns in the Chinese path as best they can, mainly cars and buses. We have MP units trying to keep them organized. So far nothing has happened to interfere with the evacuation, Tolkunov said.
See, from this it looks as if they're actually bypassing Belogorsk, just passing east of it with their reconnaissance elements.
Oh, that's the smart move, isn't it?
Bondarenko observed.
Their real objective is far to the north. Why slow down for anything? They don't want land. They don't want people. They want oil and gold. Capturing civilians will not make those objectives any easier to accomplish. If I were this Peng fellow, I would be worried about the extent of my drive north. Even unopposed, the natural obstacles are formidable, and defending his line of advance will be a beast of a problem.
Gennady paused. Why have any sympathy for this barbarian? His mission was to kill him and all his men, after all. But how? If even marching that far north was a problem, and it was,
then how much harder would it be to strike through the same terrain with less prepared troops? The tactical problems on both sides were the kind men in his profession did not welcome.
"General Bondarenko?" a foreign voice asked.
"Yes?"
He turned to see a man dressed in an American flight suit.
"Sir, my name is Major Dan Tucker. I just flew in with a downlink for our Dark Star UAVs. Where do you want us to set up, sir?"
"Colonel Tolkunov."
"Major, this is my chief of intelligence."
The American saluted sloppily, as Air Force people tended to do.
"Howdy, Colonel."
"How long to set up?"
The American was pleased that this Tolkunov's English was better than his own Russian.
"Less than an hour, sir."
"This way."
The G2 led him outside.
"How good are your cameras?"
"Colonel, when a guy's out taking a piss, you can see how big his dick is." Tolkunov figured that was typical American braggadocio, but it set him wondering. Captain Fyodor Ilyich Alexandrov commanded the 265th Motor Rifles Divisional Reconnaissance Element. The division was supposed to have a full battalion for this task, but he was all they had. And for that task, he had 8 of the new BRM reconnaissance tracks. These were evolutionary developments of the standard BMP infantry combat vehicle, upgraded with better automotive gear, more reliable engine and transmission systems, plus the best radios his country made. He reported directly to his divisional commander, and also, it seemed, to the theater intelligence coordinator, some colonel named Tolkunov. That chap, he'd discovered, was very concerned with his personal safety, always urging him to stay close, but not too close, not to be spotted, and to avoid combat of any type. His job, Tolkunov had told him at least once every 2 hours for the last day and a half, was to stay alive and to keep his eye on the advancing Chinese. He wasn't supposed to so much as injure one little hair on their cute little chink heads, just stay close enough that if they mumbled in their sleep, to copy down the names of the girlfriends they fucked in their dreams. Alexandrov was a young captain, only 28, and rakishly handsome, an athlete who ran for personal pleasure. And running, he told his men, was the best form of exercise for a soldier, especially a reconnaissance specialist. He had a driver, gunner, and radio operator for each of his tracks, plus 3 infantrymen whom he'd personally trained to be invisible. The drill was for them to spend about half their time out of their vehicles, usually a good kilometer or so ahead of their Chinese counterparts, either behind trees or on their bellies, reporting back with monosyllabic comments on their portable radios, which were of Japanese manufacture. The men moved light, carrying only their rifles and 2 spare magazines, because they weren't supposed to be seen or heard. And the truth was that Alexandrov would have preferred to send them out unarmed, lest they be tempted to shoot someone out of patriotic anger. However, no soldier would ever stand for being sent out on a battlefield weaponless, and so he'd had to settle for ordering them out with bolts closed on empty chambers. The captain was usually out with his men, their BRM carriers hidden 300 or so meters away in the trees. In the past 24 hours, they'd become intimately familiar with their Chinese opponents. These were also trained and dedicated reconnaissance specialists, and they were pretty good at their jobs, or certainly appeared to be. They were also moving in tracked vehicles, and also spent a lot of their time on foot, ahead of their tracks, hiding behind trees and peering to the north, looking for Russian forces. The Russians had even started giving them names.
"It's the gardener," Sergeant Buikov said.
That one liked touching trees and bushes, as though studying them for a college paper or something. The gardener was short and skinny, and looked like a 12-year-old to the Russians. He seemed competent enough, carrying his rifle slung on his back and using his binoculars often. He was a Chinese lieutenant, judging by his shoulder boards, probably commander of this platoon. He ordered his people around a lot, but didn't mind taking the lead. So he was probably conscientious. "He is, therefore, the one we should kill first," Alexandrov thought. their BRM reconnaissance track had a fine 30-millimeter cannon that could reach out and turn the gardener into fertilizer from 1,000 meters or so. But Captain Alexandrov had forbidden it. Worse luck, Buikov thought. He was from this area, a woodsman of sorts who'd hunted in the forests many times with his father, a lumberjack.
We really ought to kill him. Boris Yevgenievich, do you wish to alert the enemy to our presence? Alexandrov asked his sergeant.
I suppose not, my captain, but the hunting season is...
Closed, sergeant.
The season is closed, and no, he is not a wolf that you can shoot for your own pleasure. And...
Down, Alexandrov ordered.
The gardener was looking their way with his field glasses. Their faces were painted, and they had branches tucked into their field clothing to break up their outlines. But he was taking no chances.
They'll be moving soon. Back to the track.
The hardest part of their drill was to avoid leaving tracks for the Chinese to spot. Alexandrov had discussed this with his drivers, threatening to shoot anyone who left a trail. He knew he couldn't do that, of course, but his men weren't quite sure. Their vehicles even had upgraded mufflers to reduce their sound signature. Every so often, the men who designed and built Russian military equipment got things right, and this was such a case. Besides, they didn't crank their engines until they saw the Chinese doing the same. Alexandrov looked up. Okay, the gardener was waving to those behind him, the wave that meant to bring their vehicles up. They were doing another leapfrog jump, with one section standing fast and providing overwatch cover for the next move, should something happen. He had no intention of making anything happen, but of course they couldn't know that. Alexandrov was surprised that they were maintaining their careful drill into the second day. They weren't getting sloppy yet. He'd expected that, but it seemed that the Chinese were better drilled even than his expectations, and were assiduously following their written doctrine. Well, so was he.
"Move now, Captain?" Buikov asked.
"No, let's sit still and watch. They ought to stop at that little ridge with the logging road. I want to see how predictable they are, Boris Yevgenievich." But he did trigger his portable radio.
"Stand by. They're jumping again."
The other radio just clicked on and off, creating a whisper of static, rather than a spoken reply.
Good. His men were adhering to their radio discipline.
The second echelon of Chinese tracks moved forward carefully, at about 10 kilometer speed, following this opening in the forest. Interesting, he thought, that they weren't venturing too far into the adjoining woods, no more than 200 or 300 meters. Then he cringed. A helicopter chattered overhead. It was a Gazelle, a Chinese copy of the French military helicopter. But his track was back in the woods, and every time it stopped, the men ran outside to stretch the camo net around it. His men also were well drilled. And that, he told his men, was why they didn't dare leave a visible trail if they wanted to live. It wasn't much of a helicopter, but it did carry rockets. And their BRM was an armored personnel carrier. But it wasn't that armored.
"What's he doing?" Buikov asked.
"If he's looking, he's not being very careful about it." The Chinese were driving up a pathway built ages ago for an unbuilt spur off the Trans-Siberian Railroad. It was wide, in some places 500 meters, and fairly well graded. Someone in years past had thought about building this spur to exploit the unsurveyed riches of Siberia. Enough to cut down a lot of trees, and they'd barely grown back in the harsh winters. Just saplings in this pathway now, easily ground into splinters by tracked vehicles. Farther north, the work was being continued by Army engineers, making a path to the new gold find, and beyond that to the oil discoveries on the Arctic coast. When they got that far, the Chinese would find a good road, ready-made for a mechanized force to exploit. But it was a narrow one, and the Chinese would have to learn about flank security if they kept this path up.
Alexandrov remembered a Roman adventure into Germany. A soldier named Quintilius Varus, commanding 3 legions, who'd ignored his flanks, and lost his army in the process to a German named Arminius. Might the Chinese make a similar mistake? No, everyone knew of the Teutoburg forest disaster. It was a textbook lesson in every military academy in the known world. Quintilius Varus had been a political commander, given that command because he'd been beloved of his emperor, Caesar Augustus, obviously not because of his operational skill. It was a lesson probably better remembered by soldiers than by politicians. And the Chinese army was commanded by soldiers, wasn't it?
That's the fox, Buikov said.
This was the other officer in the Chinese unit, probably the subordinate of the gardener. Similar in size, but he had less interest in plants than he had in darting about. As they watched, he disappeared into the tree line to the east, and if he went by the form card, he'd be invisible for 5 to 8 minutes.
I could use a smoke, Sergeant Buikov observed.
That will have to wait, Sergeant.
Yes, Comrade Captain.
May I have a sip of water, then? He asked petulantly.
It wasn't water he wanted, of course.
Yes, I'd like a shot of vodka, too, but I neglected to bring any with me, as I am sure you did as well.
Regrettably, yes, Comrade Captain.
A good slug of vodka helps keep the chill away in these damp woods.
And it also dulls the senses. And we need our senses, Boris Yevgenievich, unless you enjoy eating rice.
Assuming the Chinks take prisoners, which I rather doubt.
They do not like us, Sergeant, and they are not a civilized people, remember that.
So they don't go to the ballet. Neither do I, Sergeant Buikov didn't say aloud. His captain was a Muscovite and spoke often of cultural matters. But, like his captain, Buikov had no love for the Chinese, and even less now that he was looking at Chinese soldiers on the soil of his country. He only regretted not killing some, but killing was not his job. His job was watching them piss on his country, which somehow only made him angrier.
"Captain, will we ever get to shoot them?" the sergeant asked.
In due course, yes, it will be our job to eliminate their reconnaissance elements, and yes, Boris, I look forward to that as well.
And yes, I could use a smoke as well, and I'd love a glass of vodka right now.
But he'd settle for some black bread and butter, which he did have in his track, 300 meters to the north. 6.5 minutes this time. The fox had at least looked into the woods to the east, probably listened for the sound of diesel engines, but heard nothing but the chirping of birds. Still, this Chink lieutenant was the more conscientious of the two, in Buikov's opinion. They should kill him first when the time came, the sergeant thought. Alexandrov tapped the sergeant on the shoulder.
Our turn to leapfrog, Boris Yevgenievich.
By your command, Comrade Captain.
And both men moved out, crouching for the first 100 meters, and taking care not to make too much noise, until they heard the Chinese tracks start their engines. In 5 more minutes, they were back in their BRM and heading north, slowly picking their way through the trees. Alexandrov buttered some bread and ate it, sipping water as he did so. When they'd traveled 1,000 meters, their vehicle stopped, and the captain got on his big radio.
"Who is Ingrid?"
Tolkunov asked.
"Ingrid Bergman," Major Tucker replied. "Actress. Good-looking babe in her day. All the dark stars are named for movie stars, Colonel. The troops did it."
There was a plastic strip on the monitor top to show which dark star was up and transmitting. Marilyn Monroe was back at Gigansk for service, and Grace Kelly was the next one up, scheduled to go in 15 hours. "Anyway," he flipped a switch and then played a little with his mouse control, "there's the Chinese lead elements."
"Son of a bitch," Tolkunov said, demonstrating his knowledge of American slang.
Tucker grinned.
"Pretty good, ain't it? Once I sent one over a nudist colony in California.
That's like a private park where people walk around naked all the time. You can tell the difference between the flat-chested ones and the ones with nice tits. Tell the natural blondes from the peroxide ones, too. Anyway, you use this mouse to control the camera. Well, somebody else is doing it now up at Gigansk. Anything in particular that you're interested in?
The bridges on the Amur, Tolkunov said at once.
Tucker picked up a radio microphone.
This is Major Tucker. We have a tasking request. Slew camera 3 onto the big crossing point.
Roger, the speaker next to the monitor said.
The picture changed immediately, seeming to race across the screen like a ribbon from 10 o'clock down to 4 o'clock. Then it stabilized. The field of view must have been 4 kilometers across. It showed a total of what appeared to be 8 bridges, each of them approached by what looked like a parade of insects.
Give me control of camera 3, Tucker said next.
You got it, sir, the speaker acknowledged.
Okay.
Tucker played with the mouse more than the keyboard, and the picture zoomed in, isolated, on the third bridge from the west. There were 3 tanks on it at once, moving at about 10 kilometers per hour south to north. The display showed a compass rose in case you got disoriented, and it was even in color.
Tolkunov asked why.
No more expensive than black and white cameras, and we put it on the system because it sometimes shows you things you don't get from gray. First time for overheads, even the satellites don't do color yet, Tucker explained.
Then he frowned.
The angle's wrong. Can't get the divisional markings on the tanks without moving the platform.
Wait.
He picked up the microphone again.
Sergeant, who's crossing the bridges now?
Appears to be their 302nd Armored Division, sir. Part of the 29th Group A Army. The 34th Army is fully across now. We estimate 1 full regiment of the 302nd is across and moving north at this time,
the intel weenie reported, as though relating the baseball scores from yesterday.
Thanks, Sarge.
Roger that, Mage.
And they can't see this drone? Tolkunov asked.
Well, on radar it's pretty stealthy. And there's another little trick we have on it.
Goes back to World War II, called Project Yehudi back then. You put lights on the thing.
What?
Tolkunov asked.
Yeah, you spot airplanes because they're darker in the sky. But if you put light bulbs on them, they turn invisible. So there are lights on the airframe, and a photo sensor dials the brightness automatically. They're damn near impossible to spot. They cruise at 60,000 feet, way the hell above contrail level, and they got no infrared signature at all, hardly, even if you know where to look. And they tell me you can't hardly make an air-to-air missile lock onto one.
Pretty cool toy, eh?
How long have you had this?
I've been working on it, about 4 years now.
I've heard of Dark Star, but this capability is amazing.
Tucker nodded.
Yeah, it's pretty slick. Nice to know what the other guy's doing. First time we deployed it was over Yugoslavia, and once we learned how to use it and how to coordinate it with the shooters, well, we learned to make their lives pretty miserable.
Tough shit, Joe.
Joe?
Joe Chink.
Tucker pointed at the screen.
That's what we mainly call him.
The friendly nickname for Koreans had once been Luke the Gook. Now, Ingrid doesn't have it yet, but Grace Kelly does, a laser designator, so you can use these things to clobber targets. The fighter just lofts the bomb in from, maybe 20 miles away, and we guide it into the target. I've only done that at Red Flag, and we can't do it from here with this terminal, but they can up at Gigansk.
Guide bombs from 600 kilometers away?
Yeah. Hell, you can do it from Washington if you want. It all goes over the satellite, you know.
Job for you, Matt.
Soon we're going to make the fighter jocks obsolete, Colonel. Another year or so and we'll be doing terminal guidance on missiles launched from a couple of 100 miles away. Won't need fighter pilots then. Guess I'll have to buy me a scarf.
So, Colonel, what else do you want to see?
The IL-86 landed at a rustic fighter base with only a few helicopters on it, Colonel Mitch Turner noted. As divisional intelligence officer, he was taking in a lot of what he saw in Russia, and what he saw wasn't all that encouraging. Like General Diggs, he'd entered the Army when the USSR had been the main enemy and principal worry for the United States Army. And now he was wondering how many of the intelligence estimates he'd helped draft as a young spook officer had been pure fantasy. Either that or the mighty had fallen farther and faster than any nation in history. The Russian army wasn't even a shadow of what the Red Army had been. The rompin', stompin' Russian red ass, so feared by NATO, was as dead as the Stegosaurus toys his son liked to play with. And right now that was not such a good thing. The Russian Federation looked like a rich family of old with no sons to defend it. And the girl kids were getting raped. Not a good thing. The Russians, like America, still had nuclear weapons. Bombs, deliverable by bombers and tactical fighters. However, the Chinese had missiles to deliver theirs, and they were targeted at cities. And the big question was whether the Russians had the stones to trade a few cities, and, say, 40 million people, for a gold mine and some oil fields. Probably not, Turner figured. Not something a smart man would do. Similarly, they could not afford a war of attrition against a country with 9 times as many people and a healthier economy, even over this ground. No, if they were to defeat the Chinese, it had to be with maneuver and agility. But their military was in the shitter, and neither trained nor equipped to play maneuver warfare. This, Turner thought on reflection, was going to be an interesting war. It was not the sort he wanted to fight. Better to clobber a dumb little enemy than mix it up with a smart, powerful one. It might not be glorious, but it was a hell of a lot safer. Mitch, General Diggs said, as they stood to walk off the airplane. Thoughts?
Well, sir, we might have picked a better place to fly to. Way things look, this is going to be a little exciting.
Go on, the general ordered.
The other side has better cards, more troops, better trained troops, more equipment. Their task, crossing a lot of nasty country, is not enviable, but neither is the Russian task, defending against it. To win, they have to play maneuver warfare. But I don't see that they have the horsepower to pull it off.
Their boss out here, Bondarenko, he's pretty good.
So was Erwin Rommel, sir, but Montgomery whooped his ass.
There were staff cars lined up to drive them into the Russian command post. The weather was clearer here, and they were close enough to the Chinese that a clear sky wasn't something to enjoy anymore. Chapter 53 Deep Concerns.
So, what's happening there? Ryan asked.
The Chinese are 70 miles inside Russia. They have a total of 8 divisions over the river, and they're pushing north, General Moore replied, moving a pencil across the map spread on the conference table. They blew through the Russian border defenses pretty fast. It was essentially the Maginot Line from 1940. I wouldn't have expected it to hold very long, but our overhead showed them punching through fairly professionally with their leading infantry formations, supported by a lot of artillery. Now they have their tanks across. About 800 to this point, with another 1,000 or so to go.
Ryan whistled. That many.
When you invade a major country, sir, you don't do it on the cheap. The only good news at this point is that we've really given their air force a bloody nose.
AWACS and 15s? Jackson asked.
Right. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs nodded. One of our kids made ace in a single engagement. A Colonel Winters.
Bronco Winters, Jackson said. I've heard the name. Fighter jock.
Okay, what else?
Our biggest problem on the air side is going to be getting bombs to our airmen. Flying bombs in is not real efficient. I mean, you can use up a whole C-5 just to deliver half the bombs for one squadron of F-15Es, and we've got a lot of other things for the C-5s to do. We're thinking about sending the bombs into Russia by train to Chitose, and then flying them up to Suntar from there.
but the Russian railroad is moving just tanks and vehicles for now, and that isn't going to change soon. We're trying to fight a war at the end of one railroad line. Sure, it's double-tracked, but it's still just one damn line. Our logistical people are already taking a lot of Maalox over this one.
Russian airlift capacity? Ryan asked.
FedEx has more, General Moore replied. In fact, FedEx has a lot more. We're going to ask you to authorize call-up of the Civilian Reserve Air Fleet, Mr. President.
Approved, Ryan said at once.
And a few other little things, Moore said.
He closed his eyes.
It was pushing midnight, and nobody had gotten much sleep lately.
VMH-1 is standing, too. We're in a shooting war with a country that has nuclear weapons on ballistic launchers. So we have to think about the possibility, remote maybe, but still a possibility, that they could launch at us. So VMH-1 and the Air Force's first heli at Andrews are standing, too. We can get a chopper here to lift you and your family out in 7 minutes.
That concerns you, Mrs. O'Day, Moore said to Andrea.
The President's principal agent nodded. We're dialed in. It's all in the book, she said. That nobody had opened that particular book since 1962 was beside the point. It was written down. Mrs. Price O'Day looked a little peaked.
You okay? Ryan asked.
Stomach, she explained.
Try some ginger, Jack went on.
Nothing much works for this, Dr. North tells me. Please excuse me, Mr. President. She was embarrassed that he'd noticed her discomfort. She always wanted to be one of the boys. But the boys didn't get pregnant, did they?
Why don't you drive home?
Sir, I...
Go, Ryan said. That's an order. You're a woman and you're pregnant. You can't be a cop all the time, okay? Get some relief here and go. Right now.
Special Agent Price O'Day hesitated, but she did have an order, so she walked out the door. Another agent came in immediately.
Machismo from a woman. What's the goddamn world coming to? Ryan asked the assembly.
You're not real liberated, Jack, Jackson observed with a grin.
It's called objective circumstances, I think. She's still a girl, even if she does carry a pistol. Kathy says she's doing fine. This nausea stuff doesn't last forever. Probably feels like it to her, though.
Okay, General, what else?
NECAP and Air Force One are on hot pad alert round the clock. So if we get a launch warning in 7 minutes or less, you and the Vice President are on choppers. 5 more minutes to Andrews, and 3 more after that, you're doing the takeoff roll. The drill is your family goes to Air Force One and you go to NECAP, he concluded. NECAP was actually the National Emergency Airborne Command Post, NEACP, but the official acronym was too hard to pronounce. Like the VC-25A that served as Air Force One, NECAP was a converted 747 that was really just a wrapper for a bunch of radios flying in very close formation.
Gee, that's nice to know.
What about my family? POTUS asked.
In these circumstances, we keep a chopper close to where your wife and kids are at all times, and then they'll fly in whatever direction seems the safest at the moment. If that's not Andrews, then they'll get picked up later by a fixed-wing aircraft and taken to whatever place seems best.
It's all theoretical, Moore explained, but something you might as well know about.
Can the Russians stop the Chinese? Ryan asked, turning his attention back to the map.
Sir, that remains to be seen. They do have the nuclear option, but it's not a card I would expect them to play. The Chinese do have 12 CSS-4 ICBMs. It's essentially a duplicate of our old Titan II liquid fuels with a warhead estimated to be between 3 and 5 megatons.
City Buster? Ryan asked.
Correct. No counterforce capability, and there's nothing we have left to use against it in that role anyway. The SEP on the warhead is estimated to be plus or minus 1,000 meters or so. So it'd do a city pretty well, but that's about all.
Any idea where they're targeted? Jackson asked.
Moore nodded at once.
Yes, the missile is pretty primitive, and the silos are oriented on their targets because the missile doesn't have much in the way of cross-range maneuverability. 2 are targeted on Washington.
others on L.A., San Francisco, and Chicago, plus Moscow, Kiev, St. Petersburg. They're all leftovers from the bad old days, and they haven't been modified in any way.
Any way to take them out? Jackson asked.
I suppose we could stage a mission with fighter or bomber aircraft and go after the silos with PGMs, Moore allowed. But we'd have to fly the bombs to Suntar first, and even then it'll be rather a lengthy mission for the F-117s.
What about B-2s out of Guam? Jackson asked.
I'm not sure they can carry the right weapons. I'll have to check that.
Jack, this is something we need to think about, okay?
I hear you, Robbie.
General, have somebody look into this, okay?
Yes, sir.
Gennady Yosifovich, General Diggs called on entering the map room. Marian Ivanovich.
The Russian came over to take his hand, followed by a hug. He even kissed his guest in the Russian fashion, and Diggs flinched from this in the American fashion.
In!
And Diggs waited for 10 seconds.
Out!
Both men shared the laugh of an insider's joke.
The turtle bordello is still there?
It was the last time I looked, Gennady.
Then Diggs had to explain to the others. Out at Fort Irwin, we collected all the desert tortoises and put them in a safe place so the tanks wouldn't squish 'em and piss off the tree-huggers. I suppose they're still in there making little turtles, but the damn things screw so slow they must fall asleep doing it.
I have told that story many times, Marion.
Then the Russian turned serious.
I am glad to see you. I will be more glad to see your division.
How bad is it?
It is not good. Come.
They walked over to the big wall map. These are their positions as of 30 minutes ago.
How are you keeping track of them?
We now have your Dark Star invisible drones, and I have a smart young captain on the ground watching them as well.
That far, Diggs said.
Colonel Masterman was right beside him now.
Duke?
Then he looked at his Russian host.
This is Colonel Masterman, my G3. His last job was as a squadron commander in the 10th Cav.
A Buffalo Soldier, yes?
Yes, sir, Masterman confirmed with a nod, but his eyes didn't leave the map.
Ambitious bastards, aren't they?
Their first objective will be here, Colonel Aliyev said, using a pointer. This is the Gogol gold strike.
Well, hell, if you're going to steal something, might as well be a gold mine, right? Duke asked rhetorically.
What do you have to stop them with?
2.65 motor rifle is here, Aliyev pointed.
Full strength?
Not quite, but we've been training them up. We have 4 more motor rifle divisions en route. The first arrives at Chita tomorrow noon.
Aliyev's voice was a little too optimistic for the situation. He didn't want to show weakness to Americans.
That's still a long way to move, Masterman observed.
He looked over at his boss.
What are you planning, Gennady?
I want to take the 4 Russian divisions north to link up with the 265th and stop them about here. Then perhaps we will use your forces to cross east through here and cut them off.
Now it wasn't the Chinese who were being ambitious, both Diggs and Masterman thought.
Moving 1st Infantry Division, mechanized, from Fort Riley, Kansas to Fort Carson, Colorado, would have been about the same distance. But it would have been on flat ground and against no opposition. Here, that task would involve a lot of hills and serious resistance. Those factors did make a difference, the American officers thought.
No serious contact yet?
Bondarenko shook his head.
No, I'm keeping my mechanized forces well away from them. The Chinese are advancing against no opposition.
You want them to fall asleep, get sloppy? Masterman asked.
Da. Better that they should get overconfident.
The American colonel nodded. That made good sense. And as always, war was as much a psychological game as a physical one.
If we jump off the trains at Chita, it's still a long approach march to where you want us, General.
What about fuel? Colonel Douglas asked.
That is the one thing we have plenty of,
answered Colonel Aliyev. The blue spots on the map, fuel storage. It is the same as your number 2 diesel.
How much? Douglas asked.
At each fuel depot, 1,250,000,000 liters.
Shit, Douglas observed. That much?
Aliyev explained. The fuel depots were established to support a large mobile force in a border conflict. They were built in the time of Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev. Huge concrete and steel storage tanks, all underground, well hidden.
They must be, Mitch Turner observed. I've never been briefed on them.
So we evaded even your satellite photos, yes?
That pleased the Russian.
Each depot is manned by a force of 20 engineers with ample electric pumps.
I like the locations, Masterman said. What's this unit here?
That is Boyar, a reserve mechanized force. The men have just been called up. Their weapons are from a hidden equipment storage bunker. It's a short division, old equipment, T-55s and such, but serviceable. We're keeping that force hidden, Aliyev said.
The American G-3 arched his eyebrows.
Maybe they were outmanned, but they weren't dumb. That Boyar force was in a particularly interesting place, if Ivan could make proper use of it. Their overall operational concept looked good, theoretically. A lot of soldiers could come up with good ideas. The problem was executing them. Did the Russians have the ability to do that? Russia's military theorists were as good as any the world had ever seen. Good enough that the United States Army regularly stole their ideas. The problem was that the U.S. Army could apply those theories to a real battlefield, and the Russians could not.
How are your people handling this? Masterman asked.
Our soldiers, you mean?
Aliyev asked.
The Russian soldier knows how to fight, he assured his American counterpart.
Hey, Colonel, I'm not questioning their guts, Duke assured his host. How's their spirit, for one thing?
Bondarenko handled that one.
Yesterday I had to face one of my young officers, Komonov, from the border defenses. He was furious that we were unable to give him the support he needed to defeat the Chinese.
And I was ashamed, the general admitted to his guests.
My men have the spirit. Their training is lacking. I just got here a few months ago, and my changes have barely begun to take effect. But you will see, the Russian soldier has always risen to the occasion, and he will today, if we here are worthy of him.
Masterman didn't share a look with his boss. Diggs had spoken well of this Russian general, and Diggs was both a good operational soldier and a good judge of men. But the Russian had just admitted that his men weren't trained up as well as they ought to be. The good news was that on the battlefield men learned the soldier's trade rapidly. The bad news was that the battlefield was the most brutal Darwinian environment on the face of the planet. Some men would learn, but others would die in the process. And the Russians didn't have all that many they could afford to lose. This wasn't 1941, and they weren't fighting with half their population base this time around.
You're going to want us to move out fast when the trains drop us off at Chita? Tony Welch asked.
He was the divisional chief of staff.
Yes, Aliyev confirmed.
Okay, well then I need to get down there and look over the facilities. What about fuel for our choppers?
Our Air Force bases have fuel storage similar to the diesel depots, Aliyev told him.
Your word is infrastructure, yes? That is the one thing we have much of.
When will they arrive?
The Air Force is still working that out. They're going to fly our aviation brigade in, Apaches first. Dick Boyle's chomping at the bit